Today on the Doc on the Run podcast, we're talking with Lindsay about Lyme disease.
Hi, I'm Dr. Christopher Segler, and thanks for tuning in to the Doc on the Run podcast, where we help you understand how to keep training and running, even if you've been injured.
I was recently out for a run on the Dipsy Trail, which goes from Stinson Beach over to Mill Valley here in California. And it's really beautiful, it's strenuous, but like most trail runs, it goes through the woods. And there are lots of critters living in the woods, including ticks. Now, while I was on that run, my legs were constantly dragging through brush, tall grass, and limbs, and I kept thinking about ticks, and I kept thinking about someone I met a few years ago at Ironman Cozumel, and her name's Lindsay. And Lindsay's been on a terrible yet truly inspiring journey with Lyme disease. And in thinking about all Lindsay has gone through this horrible disease, it occurred to me that many runners are simply unaware of the real risks associated with tick-borne illnesses. And for that reason, I thought it would be great if we could have Lindsay on the show to discuss everything she's learned about chronic Lyme disease and how to prevent it. And fortunately for all of us, she agreed. So Lindsay, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much. Happy to be here.
So before we really get into all the details about your story specifically, maybe you could just tell us briefly, like, you know, what is Lyme disease?
Sure. Well, in really simple terms, Lyme disease is a bacterial infection. It is, as you said, carried by ticks. It's the scientific name of it is Borrelia burgdorferi. Burgdorfer was the doctor that formerly first diagnosed it and named the bacteria in the United States, although it does exist worldwide. But so it's a bacterial infection, and it's carried by ticks. But the actual disease reservoir is in mostly deer and mice. So they carry the bacteria. Ticks feed on other animals besides humans, besides ourselves, and they carry the disease, and then ticks can bite humans and infect humans with that bacteria.
Right. So that's the thing, is that it is a bacterial infection, but a lot of times, you know, because we have antibiotics to treat bacterial infections, a lot of people really think of those as really not being very serious. Like a lot of people think of, you know, some viral illnesses like, you know, HIV as being really serious because there's no cure. And they think of them as a real problem, but then they kind of don't worry that much about bacterial infections because we have so many different antibiotics. And so, you know, I think that a lot of people kind of misunderstand this and think that, well, it's not a big deal. If I get bitten by a tick and I get the infection, then it's no big deal and I'll take antibiotics and it'll go away. And in, you know, in some cases that can happen, and that actually happened in my case. When I was in medical school, I actually was rock climbing at the Pinnacles National Monument, which is an hour or two south of San Francisco, and there are lots of deer there. And I was doing this series of climbs, and I would basically climb up, hike through the brush, and then walk off and then do another one, and kind of did that over and over all day. And I remember driving home, like I felt something itching in my armpit, and I sort of vaguely remembered that something itched a number of times in my armpit, and I didn't really think about it. And the next morning when I woke up, I felt something itching in my armpit again as soon as I woke up, and I went in the bathroom and looked in the mirror, and I had a tick that was embedded in my armpit, and it also had this red ring around the tick. Of course, I was in med school and in microbiology had learned about, you know, Lyme disease and the signs of the initial infection, which of course is this target lesion where you have, you know, the spot where the tick bit you as well as a ring that keeps expanding and getting bigger as it goes outward. And I had that. So I went to the student health clinic at the school, and it was kind of funny because when I went in, the nurse looked at it and was like, wow, you really do have Lyme disease. And she was a nurse practitioner, and she had a doctor that was supervising. She called and I had him on speakerphone. And I don't think he knew that I was on speakerphone, but she said, you know, hey, I have Chris here in the student clinic, and he got bitten by a tick, and he has acute Lyme disease. And he said, oh my gosh, these students, they think they have everything they read about. She said, no, he really has it. Like he has the target lesion, everything. And he said, okay, well, then just give him the antibiotic. And that's that. I got a prescription for antibiotics. I took the antibiotics, and that was kind of the end of it. But I was one of those very few people who I think actually gets and recognizes the signs of it right away and was able to treat it during the very acute phase before it turns into a really serious problem. There's a big difference between acute Lyme disease, like I got, and chronic Lyme disease, which is what you developed. Can you explain the difference between acute Lyme disease, which is sort of, I guess, consistent with a normal bacterial infection, and then chronic Lyme disease? Because they're very, very different.
Sure. And I think it's important to note, kind of in a way, you were lucky in that you did present a real classic case of Lyme. A lot of people, it's sort of a common misconception that everyone is going to get a bullseye rash, like you described, the target rash. And not everyone does, or the rash might not look so perfectly like a circle, or if they never knew they got a tick bite and they get a rash, they don't, you know, they won't connect the dots. Or you might get on your scalp or someplace on your back that you just wouldn't see it. So although it's not good luck, you know, to get Lyme, it is kind of lucky when you do get a symptom like that that is so clearly Lyme related. But so to get back to the question, the difference between acute Lyme and chronic Lyme, not to get too into the science of the bacteria itself, but something that's important to know about Lyme is it does, well, the bacteria is just, it's a highly evolved bacteria. It's been around for literally thousands of years, and it takes different forms in the body. In the acute form, the bacteria itself, which I'm sure you're familiar with this term, which is it's a spirochete. That just refers to the shape of the bacteria, and a spirochete is literally a spiral-shaped bacteria. So when you're first infected, that spiral-shaped bacteria really just lives and resides in the blood. And hopefully you're diagnosed right away, you show symptoms right away, you get on antibiotics, and that is taken care of. If that's not the case, even for some people that were on antibiotics initially, and I'll tell my story later, but I was, that bacteria being as highly evolved as it is, it uses that spiral shaped form, and it drills into tissues. It drills into joint fluid and cartilage. It can drill into muscles and organs, and it can even drill into your nervous system through safety mechanisms we have in the body, like a blood brain barrier. It can get into your brain. And it also takes other forms, what's called a cyst form, where, and other bacteria does this as well, this isn't unique to Lyme, but it'll kind of lay dormant in the body, and it'll just kind of curl up into these cysts where they come together, and they put out these films, it's like a biofilm, where it kind of just can sit in the body, especially if you have a great immune system, or if you're on antibiotics, and the bacteria likes to hide from that. It'll sort of just wait in this dormant form until it's a better environment for the bacteria to kind of come out and wreak havoc in the body later on. So the difference between acute, obviously meaning like a quick and immediate infection, and then chronic or long-term Lyme, it's usually when you have just more systemic infection and in different forms throughout the body and affecting different body systems, you know, it's not just a blood-borne pathogen anymore. It's affected maybe a nervous system, maybe your muscles, maybe your heart, different organs. And it's, of course, a longer lasting infection. I think if you went by like the CDC's definition, if it goes on beyond, I think, 3 to 6 months, symptoms of Lyme going on beyond that time, they consider that. They don't say chronic, but beyond an acute infection. So those are the main differences. And then sort of the reason why Lyme in particular as a bacteria can become chronic, whereas some bacteria that we deal with, like for instance, you know, just usually doesn't take a long course, doesn't have that chronic ability to remain in the body long term.
Right. That's the thing. It's like you really touched on this, how it attacks all these different systems. In the very early stages, just in your bloodstream. So you take antibiotics, they're in your bloodstream, it's kind of easy to treat it. But if it bores into these tissues and takes up residence in all these different tissues, obviously if it's in your muscles, it can cause problems with muscular strength, muscular pains, and so on. If it's in your joints, it can cause joint pain. If it's in your neurological system, then you can have all kinds of symptoms. I mean, you could potentially even have seizures, you could have numbness, tingling, you could have spasms in your muscles, like a lot of different neurological disorders. But because it is a neurological disorder at that point, because your neurological system's being attacked by the bacteria. Of course, you can also have organ failure. If you're an athlete and you have pain in your joint, you have muscles that aren't working, you're dropping things, you're uncoordinated because your neurological system is under attack. You know, obviously, if you're an endurance athlete, you know, you can't really afford to do endurance sports if you're having organ failure because your organs are being attacked by this stuff. For runners and athletes, it can really be crippling. What else can Lyme do to you physically?
Well, you touched on a lot of it. Certainly, things that people most commonly hear about are joint pain, fatigue, and we're not just talking about, you know, being tired or lack of energy. It's literally crushing fatigue, where the body just really doesn't have enough resources to do day-to-day tasks. Things are just exceptionally tiring. Headaches, for sure, very common symptom. Something that I had that was a physical symptom that's really quite diagnostic of Lyme is Bell's palsy, which is
Oh, yeah.
partial, sometimes for some full facial paralysis. Luckily, mine only lasted for a few weeks. That was quite scary. You can have definitely issues of balance. That was something that I really struggled with. Many people physically have issues with light and sound sensitivity. Like you said, having poor coordination, a lack of endurance. A lot of people also do lose or gain weight. I lost weight. I had some pretty severe muscle atrophy, other physical symptoms. I think those are the main physical symptoms. Many people do end up, if it does become chronic long-term, have issues with their heart. And those are really driven more by the nervous system, kind of not telling your body to do the right thing. But it's kind of a manifestation of the neurological system. You can feel and sort of see through testing that the heart isn't working right. But I think you touched on the major ones there.
Well, how did you get Lyme disease? Like, how did this all start?
My first job out of college, my undergraduate degree was environmental science, and I started working for the state of Delaware in the state parks. So I was like a field scientist, and we worked outdoors at least 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. I was outside constantly year round. Delaware is an endemic zone for Lyme. We do have a lot of ticks. And luckily for me, luckily in a way, the state was very good at educating us, and my supervisor was very good at the time educating us to be aware of ticks. We even kept a tick journal to document tick bites so that we could, refer back. If we had a bite in a certain part of our body, we would know when we were bit to keep track of that bite site, look for any signs of infection. So I had been working for the state of Delaware for about a year and a half. And over that time period, I had about a dozen ticks. I could look back in my tick journal. I still have it, but I think I had about a dozen tick bites. And I mean, I was obviously in a real high risk situation there, but even though we took precautions, we dressed in a certain way, we made sure that we, wore long sleeves, even in the summer, long pants, and we kept our shirt tucked in, and we tried to really prevent any places where ticks could get in or get onto our skin. We did tick checks every morning to make sure we didn't have a tick on us the night before. We did tick checks at the end of our shift. And then I would even, go home and immediately shower. I was just in the woods literally at least 40 hours a week. So I still had bites. And so that being said, one day in May, I remember I was really not feeling well. I was at my parents' house for some reason, maybe because I wasn't feeling well. This is all the way back in 2008, so almost 10 years ago now. I fell asleep on the couch. I was so exhausted I could not get upstairs to go to bed. And I woke up the next morning and I was in crushing, searing pain. Up to that point, I had never, ever experienced pain like that. I was sort of stuck in a fetal position. I really couldn't move my spine or my neck very well at all. And I remember just rolling off the couch and being like, what is going on? And it kind of hit me like a lightning bolt. I was like, this is Lyme. It was May. It didn't make sense that it was the flu. It just came on so suddenly. I had this insane headache. It was absolutely crushing. I think I was probably crying. I was just in such sudden and severe pain. I really could not function. So I called my family doctor right away, and he knew that I worked outdoors, and I said, I really think this is Lyme. I also had a fever. I had night sweat. And he put me on antibiotics pretty much immediately without even doing a blood test, just based on the fact that I had exposure, I had a history of tick bites, and I had this sudden onset of illness in the middle of the summer, which didn't really make sense. So that was May of 2008. And I did end up getting a blood test, and my blood test was screaming hot for Lyme. There's a couple of different tests. Unfortunately, none of them are actually really highly accurate.
Right. So it's not like strep throat where they basically swab your throat and it's positive. And you know, right then you definitely have strep throat, right? They're not that kind of test.
Yeah, they're not. I'll speak a little bit to the difficulties of testing. So the tests that we have still to this day, they're not super sensitive. And the reason being is that the tests themselves don't test for the Lyme bacteria. They test for our body's response to it. So it looks for antibodies to Lyme disease. And the body takes about, they estimate like 4 to 6 weeks to have enough antibodies in the blood to have a positive Lyme test. So there's a two-tier test, and usually doctors like to do them separately. The first test would be to see if you just have enough antibodies, that it's probable that you have an infection. And then the next test, that's called an ELISA or ELISA test. And then the next test is a Western blot, they call it. And that looks at specific bands of some outer surface proteins, but specific proteins that are unique to a spirochete and Lyme bacteria infection. So you have to have a positive test first showing that you do have antibodies to Lyme or suspected antibodies to Lyme, and then these specific bands that are sort of immune markers specific to a Lyme infection. My antibody titer was 4 times what you need to have a positive test. And then I had all of the bands that you need to have positive for an acute infection and for an infection that might have been around long term. Those bands, I don't know how much you want to get into the science of it, but they have IgG bands and IgM bands. And one looks at if you had a recent infection, and one looks at if it was if you had a previous infection. So it's similar to other testing that you'd have for mono or some other diseases where your body kind of always keeps those antibodies. So maybe you were exposed to Lyme years ago, so you might have some of the sort of old remnants that you had Lyme at one point. But if you don't have those active bands, then they wouldn't consider it an active infection, and I had all of them.
Right. So obviously you were highly educated on all this long before this happened because of the fact that you were working in an endemic area that was known to be infected, you know, highly infected with Lyme and, you know, ticks carrying Lyme disease. And then you kept a journal, you did all the right stuff, and yet you still got it. So could you look back in your journal and determine like when it was that you think you got the initial infection, or do you still not know?
No, it's really hard to say. And at some point you kind of just say, well, I'll never really know, you know,
right,
what tick it was. Or it's possible that I was infected multiple times.
Right.
But being that my test immediately following my first sign of symptoms was so positive, my doctor believed that I had it for some time.
Right. So that's what I was thinking. It just sounds like it.
Yeah. And it's possible because I was young, I didn't show symptoms until maybe I picked up a virus. And then that was like a chance for, you know, the bacteria to flourish. It's possible some people do get Lyme and, you know, never go on antibiotics for it. Their immune system just takes care of it. So maybe my immune system did for a while, and then it was provoked by something else, and it just found an opportune time to flourish. So I'll never really know, but considering how high my titers were immediately, it's pretty realistic that I'd had it for some time. And it's unfortunate because that means it had done some damage that by the time I was on treatment, it was kind of further progressed than what, you know, some people would be when they first show symptoms. So it was to the point, and I had to be tested by the state of Delaware as well, since I was working for the state of Delaware, and they said it was the highest and most positive Lyme test they had ever seen on their record.
Right. Not exactly a distinction you wanted, though, right?
No, but it is in a way lucky that I had a positive test. Some people don't, and then they are misdiagnosed for quite some time. So it was in a way lucky that I showed positive.
Right. So then basically, depending on how you characterize it, it sounds like on initial presentation, you more or less had chronic Lyme already because you had all of these positive signs that often don't show up until you've had it for a long time. So you've had some damage, you know, and you had some really serious symptoms right at the get-go. Did you still get the normal initial treatment of just like the same sort of antibiotics that I got when I got bitten by the tick and noticed the bullseye on my armpit?
Yeah, I did. I think it's unfortunate. Lyme, I mean, even, you know, this, like I said, it's going back 9 years. So it wasn't taken as seriously then. It still sometimes isn't taken really serious. Not that my doctor didn't know I was sick, but he didn't really do anything beyond the typical treatment, which most people get treated. If they're lucky, they get like 4 weeks of doxycycline. My doctor wanted to give me 6 weeks of it. I did get Bell's palsy, and I had Bell's palsy for about 3 weeks. He was concerned that in and of itself, you know that you have neurological Lyme at that point, that it's attached to your nervous system. That's a neurological symptom. So he put me on 6 weeks of doxycycline, and I felt considerably better after that time. I was probably about 80, maybe 90%, but probably about 80% better. I had stopped working for a month. I mean, I was in really bad shape, but I was really much better. And then this is kind of unlucky, though. In my case in particular, I actually, at that time in my life, was waiting for an assignment to go overseas for the Peace Corps. And because I had improved and we thought that everything was on the up and up, I went overseas then, and I
left the U.S. and I started on my Peace Corps journey. So I wasn't being seen by a doctor. I was in a country where they didn't even have Lyme. But to my knowledge, and what really the accepted belief was at the time, was that this is an acute infection. You're not going to have long-term complications of this. Take the full course of the antibiotics and you'll be fine. And I really thought that was the case then. And I think my doctor did too. It wasn't the case.
Yeah, so that's the thing, is that, you know, you can have some pretty serious complications from this disease. And, you know, you mentioned Bell's palsy, which it's, you know, you get more or less numbness and loss of control of the muscles in one side of your face. So when you smile, your smile's crooked, your eye doesn't really move up and down. You can even get some dryness in your eye, you know, if your eye droops at all. But it's just a sign that you've had some kind of neurological damage, right? It's very specific and it's noticeable
because
it's in your face. I have a friend that has Bell's palsy that has been there for years, and it's not something that's going to really disrupt his ability to do anything, but it's one of the many things that can happen. And so, like, in terms of you being young and athletic and active, I mean, what happened to you in terms of what was the sort of before and after in terms of your physical activity, your activity, your energy, all that sort of stuff, before and after you developed the sort of chronic Lyme complications?
Well, I would say beforehand, I mean, I was really physically fit. I've always been somewhat of an athlete. I played soccer growing up. I got into running. I was just always fit and I liked to be an active person. I never had issues really with energy besides, you know, having, you know, you work hard, and I had a physically demanding job, so I get tired, but I never felt like levels of exhaustion that I had since having Lyme disease. And I don't know that that's ever something that I will fully regain. I've just never been able to have the endurance to kind of just go and get everything I need to get done in a day and do that day in and day out. I got into the habit of just sort of like working for the weekend, and something that became really common in my life was just going Monday through Friday and then crashing on the weekend and trying to catch up. And I think everybody has, you know, issues, times in their life where they wish they had more energy. But I feel like I've always kind of been in a deficit since that time. It seems like my body just requires more rest. And when I have been more physically active or training or playing a sport, it really takes my body a lot longer to recover from exercise. I still will exercise, but I might know that, you know, I can't work out every day. It might be only every 2 or 3 days. So energy is a big one. I've had persistent headaches really since I was diagnosed with Lyme. So it was right before I turned 25, and I'm almost 34 now. And I never had headaches prior to that, but I do get headaches a lot. I also, something that unfortunately was chronic coming from Bell's palsy, and it might have something to do with my headaches. My left pupil doesn't respond to light properly. That was the side of my face that was paralyzed. So I get really sensitive to the sun. My pupil just doesn't close very fast or completely. So it does affect my vision. And so that was something that changed. And then something that came on much slower, but has really become a profound issue in my life in the past 2 years or so, the neurological damage it did to my autonomic nervous system, which that's the part of your nervous system, I'm sure, as you know, but it controls the automatic processes. So things like digestion and heart rate and blood pressure and things like blinking and things you just don't consciously think about. So my autonomic nervous system was really just thrown into a tailspin about 2 years ago when I had a real serious relapse. And I started having really bad heart problems, which I've never had before. And fortunately, my blood pressure is constantly really, really low. I'm lucky if it's ever 90 over 60, but it was much lower than that, like 70s over 40. And to compensate for that, my heart just beats really fast. You as a runner, I'm sure you're used to having a low resting heart rate, and I was too. Maybe like 50s or 60s. And then it got to the point where my resting heart rate was like 120, 130, which kind of makes you feel like you're having a panic attack all the time. Your body's just so hard to pump blood around the body. So that became really problematic for me. And it's much better and much more under control now, but it was something that So no amount of Lyme treatment was going to help. I had to go on medications to bump up my blood pressure and take IV fluids in and just do things to get my heart a rest. And then that, it's kind of like you run the marathon all the time, so it makes you really tired because your body's working really hard just to do these automatic things that it used to do kind of without thinking about it, that now are taking a lot more energy from other tasks that, you know, your body needs to do. So then I was having issues where I wasn't getting enough blood to my brain because my blood pressure is so low. So that causes a whole nother host of problems. So those are some of, that's kind of a progression of how things went. You know, in the beginning, it was just like headaches, fatigue, joint pain. And then it got to the point where, especially once there's more neurological involvement, memory loss that was noticeable to me, but even more so like to my family and friends. I didn't know I was repeating myself a lot. I couldn't remember anything without writing it down. It became really problematic at work. I was having word recall difficulties, which I still do from time to time, but just issues with language, really not being able to keep up in conversation. And some of that might have been due to the fact that I was having some blood soil issues in my brain, but some of it is just neurological Lyme disease and its nature. And it's hard to kind of test for those things, but I've had MRIs and I have lesions in my brain, unfortunately, from Lyme. So they're kind of just dead spots in my brain where there's been an infection. And also there are some dead spots in my brain or lesions, whatever you want to call them, where pain receptors live. And I just have had pain for so long that my neurologists have told me, well, at some point your brain just doesn't want to feel pain anymore, doesn't want to tell the rest of your body to feel pain. So it shuts those areas down. So it's kind of, you know, it's not fun to talk about, but there are lasting complications from Lyme. And unfortunately, you know, that's the boat that I'm in. It's not everyone has that type of manifestation from the illness, but some people definitely do. And some people have it much worse than me. Like you said, some people have seizures. Some people have really severe cognitive difficulties. Anxiety and depression are really common with Lyme disease, as it does affect your brain chemistry. So there's a lot of psychiatric presentations in it. Insomnia is definitely an issue for me and a lot of people with Lyme. And then certainly if you're not getting enough rest, you know, eventually your body kind of falls apart just due to that. So it can present itself in many different ways, but chronic Lyme does look different than acute Lyme, for sure.
Even though you had, I guess you could say in some ways, fortunately, this dramatic onset with this sort of crushing pain and headaches and everything else that was, you know, sort of indicative of Lyme, you did at least get a diagnosis relatively quickly when that went on, but, you know, right when it started. So even though you've been having all these issues for almost a decade, right, you were fortunate in that you at least knew you had a problem. And there's an interesting documentary called Under Our Skin. And in that documentary, I mean, it's been a long time since I've seen it, but I remember them talking about the fact that some people, it's not that dramatic. It comes on very gradually. It sort of gradually gets worse. Some people, it comes out of nowhere and gets suddenly worse after it's been kind of relatively benign for some time, but it's unpredictable. And that documentary is really fascinating. But part of what I found to be most interesting, given that I'm a doctor, is the fact that there, at least at that time, so many people simply denying even the existence of chronic Lyme. And one of the key players in that documentary was a doctor from North Carolina who sort of specialized in treating chronic Lyme. And he was actually reported to the medical board, and as I recall, by the doctors working for the insurance companies, because, you know, insurance companies don't want to pay for things. And they viewed this as a threat to profits, I think, in some way. At least it's portrayed somewhat in that light in that documentary, and basically had his license suspended, said that he was, you know, was accused of unprofessional conduct. And I remember very clearly that there were people wailing in the audience in the courtroom when they said that he was guilty of these charges of inappropriately diagnosing and treating patients with Lyme disease and using long-term IV antibiotics simply because it was a departure from recognized standards of treating Lyme, which is kind of silly given that so many people in the medical field were still denying that chronic Lyme is a disease. It's a really interesting documentary that certainly talks about these issues, but I think it's changed some since that time. But in 2006, that was pretty close to when you got diagnosed, and that was when he was charged by the medical board with unprofessional conduct, which just seems ludicrous to me. I assume you've seen that documentary and you know about the doctor that I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, I have seen that, and there's been a sequel to that called Emergence, which is also really worthwhile to watch. It's kind of like been the only real voice I think a lot of Lyme patients have had for their cause. So it's, I really appreciate that those documentaries were made. I don't think many people really did take Lyme as seriously as they should have. And those documentaries helped sort of change the landscape. And I do know about the doctor very well, Dr. Jemczyk. He is my doctor now, and he practices in D.C. There's a lot of factors at play in that are highlighted in that film, and you did touch on some of them. It really is odd to me how controversial of a disease Lyme has become. What I find really odd when you just think about it in just really basic scientific terms, any other infection that someone has, you just treat with antibiotics. I mean, nobody wants to be on long-term antibiotics, right? We know that there are dangers to that and repercussions of that, but often nobody wants to have a chronic infection. So we know that Lyme is a really highly evolved, really powerful infectious agent, and you have to treat it or the body's going to just be continually damaged. So I always found it odd that, you know, there was like this arbitrary cutoff. Well, after 4 weeks or 28 days of doxycycline, you know, in my case, I was lucky, I got an extra 2 weeks. After 6 weeks of antibiotics, you're cured. And that's always really been the CDC stance. And so doctors take their playbook from that. But it's weird when the CDC also states, but, you know, up to 30% of patients won't be well after that treatment window. And they really don't give any options for, well, what do you do after that? The only options they say are then you treat it symptomatically. Not to get too far off topic, but I was in that position for years when I first started having these symptoms creeping back in. Doctors wanted to treat everything separately and symptomatically. So here's a medication for migraines. I was having insomnia. Here's something to take to sleep. I was having depression, anxiety. I had anxiety really for the first time in my life. It was just awful. But here's something for anxiety, and here's something for pain, and I was having problems with my digestion, and here's something for that. And I tried to do that for a while, because I, you know, listened to sort of mainstream medical community and said, well, like, the infection's gone. This is just damage from, lasting damage from the infection. So let's treat the symptoms. But I was having such bad responses to the medication. I'm just a person sensitive to medication. I'm not a really big person. So I was constantly trying out new meds. And I finally got to the point where I'm like, well, nobody can really prove that this infection is gone. And I underwent a spinal tap, and we found that I did have an infection in my nervous system, in my spinal fluid. I had Lyme bacteria. So at that point, I said, this is crazy. I need to be back on treatment. And it literally took 2 years of me really going head to head with doctors and saying, no, I'm tired of treating the symptoms. Let's at least attempt to treat the cause of this. So I was put on IV antibiotics, and once again, only for 4 weeks, because that's all the CDC says you need, and that's all insurance companies are willing to cover. And it made a small dent, and I got a little bit better for a short time, but it didn't clear the infection out. And that was 2 years after I was first diagnosed. And I always wonder, you know, if I would have stayed on them longer then, you know, would I have the problems that I have now? So yeah, I think it's really unfortunate. And I don't quite understand why Lyme is looked at differently than other infections. Like if somebody had meningitis, I think we would treat it with antibiotics until they didn't have brain swelling, right? And people that have long-term viral issues like HIV and AIDS, which Dr. Jemczyk, he's an infectious disease doctor, but his initial specialty was HIV patients. And until he started having lots and lots of Lyme disease cases walking into his office, and he eventually switched gears. But he found that there were a lot of similarities between his HIV AIDS patients and his Lyme patients, and that their immune system was constantly under attack from an infection. And so, yeah, I think it's unfortunate that for whatever reason, doctors can't treat patients until their symptoms go away. And it's really more that it's not the doctors can't, it's the insurance companies aren't allowing it. And it comes at the detriment of patients' health. And it's really quite silly, too, because we're talking about antibiotics, which have been around for decades and decades, and they really aren't expensive medications. But when you have to pay for them out of pocket yourself, they are. And when doctors are fighting lawsuits, then guess what? The cost for their appointments go up, and they can't take insurance anymore, so the cost of the patient goes up. So it's quite a unique situation, I think, Lyme sufferers find themselves in. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm just short-sighted on this, but I don't know that there's really a lot of other diseases out there right now where patients are having to really advocate for themselves to get treatment until they're in remission or until they respond, until the infection is gone. I don't know of other illnesses where there's this big controversy. So it seems really odd to me. And it's very frustrating.
Sure it is. You know, I don't take insurance because I treat athletes, and it's not possible to help athletes figure out how to get over their injury, continue running, maintain their fitness, make sure it doesn't happen again, and then continue to mitigate the risk of the infection as they continue to train for some specific race. You can't do that in 7 minutes and take somebody's insurance. It doesn't work. And when you have a complicated case like yours, it's not something that you're just going to go see your primary care doctor and see you and 10 other people that hour and sort out your problem. It's extremely complicated. And then there's the issue of cost. It's very, very expensive. You know, and doctors may not offer the treatment to you for lots of reasons. Some of that's because insurance won't pay for it. And then that leaves you to pay for it. It leaves you to sort out, like, what are the options? How do you, you know, get real treatment? But then you have to figure out how to pay for it. And it is extremely expensive. I mean, the pharmaceutical companies charge a lot of money for medications because they're expensive. They're expensive to make, and they're extremely expensive to get FDA approval for medications, and they have to pay for that. So that gets passed on in the patients in terms of really expensive medications sometimes. So, mm-hmm. So you're on this long, long course of antibiotics. So how expensive is that? I mean, can you just give us an idea of like what it costs for somebody to really treat the root cause of the problem?
Sure. And it is certainly different for every person. I attempted to not use antibiotics when I had this sort of most recent relapse 2 years ago. I'm like, well, they didn't help me before, and I didn't really know as much then as I do now. So I sought out really every alternative remedy first, which also, you know, added to the cost. But one thing I did do that I think is really helpful, and I'll just mention in case there's any listeners out there that are looking for something that they can do that's not a pharmaceutical, I found acupuncture, and that really did help me. It really kind of hit the reset button on my nervous system and really supported my body to do as best as it could do on its own. So I did that, and I still do that. I take a lot of supplements, which I pay for out of pocket. And then I did get to the point where I was strong enough to go back on antibiotics. I don't want to get too far away from your question, but there is an issue with Lyme in that if you haven't treated for a while and you have an infection, you have a pretty high like bacterial load, what they call it, where you have a lot of the bacteria in your body. When you first treat, it wakes up the infection, it's sort of like poking the bear, and you can have a real flare up of symptoms. It's called a Herx reaction. It happens in diseases beyond Lyme disease, but you can have a really severe increase in symptoms. And that happened to me a couple summers ago. And it's when I was living by myself in New York City in my apartment, and I'm trying all these different medications, and I was having kind of like small seizures. I lost the ability to talk. Sometimes I couldn't walk, and it was really scary to try to, you know, be living on my own and trying medications and not know what's going on. Should I go into the hospital? Is this normal? And it was that I really hadn't treated my infection for, at that point, 7 years, and that I was just having these huge like die-off reactions of and waking up the bacteria. So it was a real slow process for me to get back on antibiotics. I did a lot of things just to kind of support my body and a lot of rest until I felt like I was able to get back on antibiotics. And a lot of that honestly was finding the right doctor that was willing to. And that, so it took a lot of research to found a handful of doctors that I believed in that had a good track record for getting patients well. None of them took insurance, and all of them had wait lists. And finally, I got to the point where early last year in 2016, I made a decision I needed to move back home to Delaware, and I moved in with my parents. I had lost my job at that point. I had spent all my savings going to specialists in New York City, and I finally had to kind of throw in the towel and go, I can't do this on my own. So I was waitlisted to be on one of Dr. Jemczyk's patients. He has a clinic in Washington, D.C. now. He does not take insurance. So just to give you some idea, like a first appointment with him would be about $800, which is very typical. And it's no more or less than other doctors were charging. And then all your follow-up appointments are about $400. But so I've had a port, and I had like a PICC line, which is an IV line in my arm since last February. And then in this year, that was moved and put in my chest. So it kind of looks like a port. And that was in March of this year. And all last year really was getting me strong enough to start course of IV antibiotics. And it was also filled with fundraising. Dr. Jensik, once you decide you're a candidate for IV antibiotics, which I was and I am, you actually have to put down, if you want to get into the math, you have to put down $39,000 to start treatment. And it's assumed that the entirety of the treatment, which in my case will last about 9 months, will cost anywhere between $70,000 to $80,000 just for the medication. And I know that sounds astronomical, and it is. So I started a crowdfund site, and I was lucky enough to have some friends do some fundraisers for me. And so really, my treatment was stalled until I had the money to do that, which in the end was good because it gave my body time to prepare. I got some of my other symptoms in check, and I was really in a place mentally and physically where I was ready to start treatment. But so if you're just looking at Lyme treatment, it'll be, you know, with everything else included too, it's like over $100,000. And then you're looking at lost income from not working for a couple of years. So well over, you know, $250,000. And it's like crazy to think about it. I think about when I did my taxes earlier this year and all the medical deductions I took. And it's really frustrating when you think about it, but it's the reality of the situation. And I decided, you know, I really believe that this is the path that would get me well. And I think it is. It's not a viable path for so many people, though. It's just financially out of reach for many. So nothing is paid for by insurance, and yet I still have to pay to have insurance every month. I really can't use it. But so I'd say I spend about $5,000, more like $7,000 a month on IV medication. And it's kind of crazy, but it's working. You can't really put a dollar amount on that.
It's two issues. Some people, you know, have insurance and they think that, well, if anything goes wrong, it's just covered. And that's just not true. I mean, it is really not true. Not in this country.
Yeah, it's not.
If you have something go wrong and you fit into one of these boxes, then sure, it may be covered. You just pay your copay and everything's taken care of. But for many people, it's not covered. And there are lots of people that don't have insurance anyway. I mean, I talked to somebody recently who broke her foot, wants to be active, wants to make sure that it heals quickly and all that, and was trying to decide whether or not it's worth paying, you know, $10,000 to $20,000 to have surgery to fix the foot. Is it worth the expense? Well, that's just a broken foot. You know, that's different than having basically your entire body attacked in a way that may not just make it difficult for you to run a marathon, but like difficult to go to work, difficult to do anything. So it is extremely difficult to pay for these kinds of treatments. But you mentioned that you started some crowdfunding sites. If you want to mention those, we'll also put a link in the show notes where people can go and access those. So what are your crowdfunding sites?
Thanks. So I have a fundraiser through CrowdRise. I've had it up since last year. That was a really difficult thing to do. I had so many people tell me for months, Lindsay, you need help. And I didn't want to put my story out there. I was afraid about, you know, repercussions with work, getting back to work. I didn't really want people to know how sick I really was. But that was my only option at that point. So my fundraiser is still active. It's on crowdrise.com. And if you just search Lindsay Lyme Treatment, and my name's Lindsay, I'll come up. And it tells more about my story, and it has some links to learn some more information about Lyme. And I hope that telling my story, I found out that it's helped a lot of people learn how to get care for themselves. I know, unfortunately, a lot of people in Delaware that are dealing with Lyme, where their kids are. I've been lucky to have a really successful fundraiser. We raised about $27,000. My goal was to raise another $23,000. That would bring me up to $50,000 just to help offset some of my costs. But if it weren't for that fundraising platform, I would not have ever had the money to put down deposit to start treatment. As hard of a decision it was, it was the right decision. So yeah, crowdrise.com, that's where my fundraising is.
Okay, great. Well, we'll definitely put links in there so people can access it.
Thank you.
It's just incredible like how difficult this can be. And it's really difficult to pay for it. And even when people have money, it's difficult for them to sort of justify that expense. But if you don't have the money, like, what do you do? And it's such an enormous problem. You mentioned, like, you know, kids with Lyme disease and thinking about, like, well, anybody would do anything for their kids. And, you know, recently I actually was on a Cub Scout camp out with my 9-year-old son, and we were on a Boy Scout reservation in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And there were signs everywhere that warned that this was a tick-infested area. We were told about Lyme disease, yet many parents just refused to use any kind of insect repellent. They seemed to have the attitude of like, well, we know that insect repellent is toxic, so we're not going to use that because I don't want that on my kids because I only feed them organic strawberries and everything else. I definitely don't want to put something toxic on their skin. And of course, it wasn't long before I actually heard one of the fathers asking the staff if they could help remove a tick that was embedded in his son's belly button. I'm a sports med and podiatrist. I'm not an epidemiologist, an infectious disease doctor, or an internal medicine doctor. However, as a father, I found this really alarming. It's sort of like hearing that someone's son came down with polio because they refused to get the polio vaccination. And, you know, everybody has a right to make whatever decision they want, but to me, that seems foolish. And insect repellent may be toxic, but I use insect repellent. I mean, I sprayed it on, you know, the cuffs of my pants, on my son's pants. You know, we sprayed it on our clothing. Neither one of us got any tick bites. Neither of us picked up any ticks, at least not that we could find. You know, I thought it was worth the risk to do that. You know, I've been bitten by lots of ticks myself. As a kid, I would get tick bites all the time at summer camp when we would like go to the lake house in the summer, all that sort of stuff. But that was before Lyme disease had spread all across the country. It took me until like, I don't know when that was, 2000 maybe, when I was in med school, when I got the tick with Lyme disease. So it happened to me, but I was lucky. You know, again, I was really lucky and I'm aware that I was really lucky. So I certainly don't want my son to wind up with chronic Lyme disease. And I shave my head, so it's easy for me to see if there's a tick on my head, but my son has lots of hair. I remember getting ticks in my hair, like behind my ears. He's not really one that would notice a tick right away. That's how I weigh the risk of insect repellents. You know, there are other options, right? So like, what would you recommend to people? Because obviously you're even trained in this about what to do to prevent ticks that could carry Lyme. Like, what would you recommend to people?
I think it's really important to remember that, and if my story is any indication, the only way to prevent having Lyme or chronic Lyme is to prevent ever having a tick bite. You know, I just don't believe in, well, get bit by a tick, hopefully it doesn't have Lyme, and then if you do, then you just treat it. Prevent the bite. And if you do get bit, honestly, at this point in my life, I would treat the bite regardless of if I had any symptoms. That's a different discussion, but there are people that will treat tick bites prophylactically with antibiotics. So you have to prevent the tick bite. And there are different ways you can do it. Before we even talk about repellents, the way you dress outdoors is really important. And I know you mentioned children, but since you're a runner and I'm getting back into running, runners should really, it's not going to look cool, but wear long socks, especially if you're running on trails. Wear higher socks, white socks, so you can see if there's a black bottom, a tick, or wear like half sleeves. So, you know, you have some coverage on your leg, or if you're out guarding, you know, it doesn't look cool, but, and I did this when I worked for the state park, tuck your pants into your socks and put your socks over your pants, you know, close up all those areas where ticks can get in. But then when it comes to repellent, there's a couple ways you can go. DEET is good. I am of the mindset, I don't like the idea of putting a pesticide on my skin. But there's nothing wrong with putting it on clothing, especially if it's outdoor clothing. It's not like you're dousing your whole wardrobe in chemicals. You can put it on your shoes. You can put it on, like you said, the cuffs of your pants. You can put it on socks. I don't like the idea of kids being, I don't have any kids, but I don't like the idea of kids wearing like those like Crocs shoes and like sandal type stuff. If you're out playing, you know, put them in sneakers. Kids aren't going to be paying attention to the little tiny ticks crawling on them. So, but you can treat the clothing. You don't have to treat your skin.
We did that. We both wear, you know, like he, of course, in Cub Scouts, he's got like a Cub Scout ball cap, and I sprayed the stuff on his uniform and his pants, his sneakers. And so it's not like I'm just hosing him from top to bottom in DEET, but it certainly, I think it's worth having on the clothing for sure.
Yeah. And so beyond DEET, permethrin is actually the best pesticide for ticks in particular. Permethrin, P-E-R-M-E-T-H-R-I-N. It's something that you can actually buy, like if you looked online, you can find pre-treated clothing that has permethrin in it that's good for like 30 or 50 washes. It might be worth it once a season, you know, that you get that for yourself or your kids. Something that is, it is toxic. It's more toxic than DEET. It's not something you'd ever apply to your skin. Put it on the outside of your shoes. And then something I say is like, you know, those are clothes that are outdoor clothes. You can take them off in the garage or take them off outside. Take the shoes off at least outside, put them in a plastic bag. You don't want to be tracking then that pesticide throughout your house. Be careful when you're putting that type of clothing on and off. Be cautious with how you store it. But permethrin, actually, if a tick crawls onto a surface treated with permethrin, it can actually kill the tick on contact, or the tick will just be so turned off by the toxic nature of it that they, you know, they won't attach, they won't climb any further till they find skin. So it's really effective. And it's really important, like I said, you got to prevent the bite. Don't get a bite and then worry about treating a bite. Prevent the bite fully. And the other thing you can do, if you do want something to put on your skin, essential oils, which are like all the rage now, are really effective. And most of our pesticides actually come from natural compounds. Permethrin comes from, I think it's marigolds, but don't quote me on that, but it comes from natural plant-based source. One thing I did want to mention about that, though, if you have cats, cats are really sensitive to permethrin, so just be cautious. But essential oils are really effective in deterring ticks. You know, I can't say they're as effective as traditional pesticides, but certain essential oils, in particular lemongrass, clove, eucalyptus, and cedar or cedarwood, are really good at deterring ticks and other insects, mosquitoes as well. So that's something that, and those oils should be diluted if you're putting them on your skin. But there are options for tick repellent that you can purchase that is all natural. At least it's doing something. So if you really don't want to use traditional pesticides, essential oils are an option that helps. And definitely taking a look at how you're dressing when you go outdoors is a really important thing to do.
Yeah. And I mean, I definitely am an offender with that. You know, I run in the same stuff all the time, and I'll go run on the trails and I'm wearing really short ankle socks with my running shoes. And half the time I'm wearing my, you know, like mankini, uncovered mostly. And when I'm on the trail, the other people I see are usually wearing either like jogging shorts and no shirt at all. Or maybe they're wearing a t-shirt, but it's like, we're all just kind of asking for it with that sort of attire.
The other thing that's important is just being aware of where you are when you're outside. If for those people that don't know, like ticks don't just like to be everywhere outside. The way that they will find a host to feed on is they crawl up onto shrubbery or grasses. They like to get kind of high, like a foot or two off the ground. And then they just sit, they perch out there with their legs outstretched. And when something moves and brushes by them, they will just close their legs on it and crawl on that thing until they find skin or a nice warm place to be, and then that's where they decide to feed. So if you are trail running, stay on the trails. Like if it's a single track trail, you know, try not to brush up against vegetation. If you're in your yard, ticks do not like sunny, dry areas. So be in a sunny area. Don't be in a moist edge of the woods, edge of a trail. Stay in open, bright areas. There's less of a chance that there's going to be ticks in those areas. So it's just good to be aware of those things. Ticks, unfortunately, really are everywhere. They are at the beach. They're ticks that live in dunes and dune grasses. That's enough vegetation for them. Don't think just because you're not in the woods, you know, you're safe. They are on playgrounds. You know, they aren't just where you have high deer population. They are carried around by mice, which there are mice everywhere. To carry around by squirrels. So, but you can limit just your exposure, even if you're not willing to put on a chemical pesticide. You can limit your exposure by just being aware of where you are and where ticks like to be, which are shady, cool, moist environments.
Right.
That's important to know.
Well, the Dipsy Trail in particular, many sections of it, it sort of gets crisscrossed by all these deer trails. And the Dipsy Trail basically follows the water as it comes down Mount Tam toward the ocean, towards Stinson Beach. So there are lots of very shady, very moist areas that are cool and sort of perfect for ticks. And, you know, I think that is it, to be aware of that. And that's what was really had me thinking about it. When I was running through those sections, I was thinking about you and the tick exposure and the risk associated with where I was running. So if a runner comes down with any symptoms of chronic Lyme, maybe they got bit by a tick before, they weren't even aware of it. Like you said, they never saw the target lesion, any of that stuff. What would your advice be to them?
Well, let me step back for just a minute, because I want to say one more thing about being outdoors and what you can do to limit your exposure. And then I will answer that question. Something I think that's good to have, not necessarily maybe on your person, but like in, you know, in your car, or, you know, just very accessible, is sort of like a mobile tick kit. Have a pair of tweezers, have some alcohol swabs, Have hand sanitizer, maybe even like a little magnifying glass. But in case you do get bit by a tick, it does take a little bit of time for them to impart any kind of pathogens that they're carrying. So the quicker you can remove it, the better. So it's like it would just be awful to be bit by a tick and be out in the woods or wherever and not be able to get that thing off you as quick as possible. So and just having a set of tweezers in the car, or even like, you know, if you're running and you keep like a little belt around you that for your cell phone or whatever, just have a pair of tweezers in there. It's something really small that you can carry and that could really help you out. So that's one thing I wanted to touch on. And also keep little Ziploc bags, because something that you may not know, and this is part of the advice that I would give to any athlete or runner, anyone that's been bit by a tick, keep the tick. I know people just want to get rid of it, probably want to flush it down the toilet, whatever, but put it in a little plastic bag, make sure it's sealed very well, and put that in your freezer. That'll kill the tick pretty quickly. And there are testing facilities, more and more popping up all the time, but there are labs that will test the tick for tick-borne illnesses. We've only talked about Lyme. We don't really have time to talk about other tick-borne illnesses, but ticks do carry a host of other diseases that, unfortunately, just like Lyme, we don't have really good sensitive and accurate tests for those diseases in the human body, but labs can find those diseases in tick very accurately. So there's one testing facility I'll mention, and it's good for you because it's in your neck of the woods, is the Bay Area Lyme Foundation, out of San Francisco Bay. They have a lab in California and also another like overflow lab in Arizona where they will test ticks for free. So if you send that tick to them, and it does have to be, and I can send you a link to this, you can put this on your webpage as well, but it does have to be received within about 72 hours for the test to be valid. But they'll test it for a host of illnesses, and then it's great because, you know, you might not have a positive test result, and hopefully, you know, if even if you had a tick bite, you didn't necessarily get any diseases from the tick, but say in the future you do have any kind of issue, you can really isolate what that disease-causing pathogen is, and therefore what type of treatment options are available for that particular type of infection. Because some people do get tick-borne illnesses that aren't Lyme, and so they're not going to respond to traditional antibiotics because it's not what they're dealing with. So that's a really valuable thing that people can do, is actually save the tick and have the tick tested. It's free with the Bay Area Lyme Foundation anyways. And then it's really great because then they have this reservoir, this huge database that they're building of what diseases are carried by what type of ticks and what parts of the country. So it's just a really good thing to do.
That's fantastic. So the last question I have for you, Lindsay, is, you know, how can our listeners follow you and your progress with what's been going on with your Lyme treatment? Because you said you have kind of turned a corner recently, but, you know, how can people follow you? Do you have a blog or anything that where you've been posting stuff? Where can people follow you?
Actually don't. I've had so many people tell me to do it. And honestly, I just sometimes it's like Lyme all the time. And I just need a break from it. So I don't have a blog. But I do post a lot on my Facebook page. And if people see this and then they want to friend me and, you know, just send me a Facebook message. And I'm always willing to accept friends that, you know, just want to learn more about Lyme. But I do post updates on my progress on my CrowdRise fundraiser. I use that as a means to just let people know how I'm doing. I haven't posted an update in a while. I was waiting to be able to post a positive update. And since I've been doing better in the last month, I'll probably post one pretty soon. So I do post updates there. And I do post links there to, like I have links for the documentaries we spoke about, and there has been an emergent link to a couple different nonprofits that just have really good information about ticks and tick-borne diseases in Lyme from A to Z, from prevention to treatment, alternative treatment. So I have links on there. So I'm always willing to talk to people personally about it, or you can follow, you know, you don't have to support my fundraiser, but you can just check it out to to see how I'm doing. And that's where I put most things online, is there with my fundraiser.
Well, that's great. We'll definitely have those links in there. And again, Lindsay, I'm really grateful that you've decided to come on and share your whole story with others. I know it's a difficult thing to do. You know, it's not something that most people are open about when they have something that's really been a struggle. And I'm really grateful for your willingness to just talk about it so that others can learn and hopefully prevent the tick-borne illnesses that could lead to the same kind of trouble that you've had. You know, it's really generous of you to come on and do that. And I'm really thank you for coming on to the show.
Sure. I mean, I just appreciate having an outlet. It's not always something I like to talk about. It's something I end up talking about quite frequently anyways, because people do come to me because it's hard to find really good information about Lyme. It can be really confusing. And I'm just happy to have a place where I can share my experience really in the hope that it prevents someone else being in a similar situation. Because like I said, once you're bit by a tick, you really just don't know what the future holds for you. But if you can prevent that, and I think awareness is really the only way to do that, if you can prevent that, then you really hopefully will never have to deal with Lyme or any tick-borne disease. So I'm appreciative to you to have the opportunity.
Well, I will certainly take what you've shared with us, and I'll take that to heart. And you probably won't catch me running on the Dipsy Trail in my mankini anymore.
Good.
That'll be good for everybody for lots of different reasons. So thanks, Lindsay, and keep getting better, and we will all go to your page there and follow you, and we'll look for that positive update coming up soon, all right?
Thank you. Take care.
If you have a question that you would like answered as a future edition of the Doc on the Run podcast, send it to me, and then make sure you join me in the next edition of the Doc on the Run podcast. Thanks again for listening.